title of my talk is Neutron Star Surface Composition Theory Observation. For this talk, I'm going to actually take a reduced definition of neutron stars. I'm actually going to just talk about young radio pulsars and like central sources in supernova remnants. So I'm going to skip my entire classes of objects, like LMXDs, millisecond pulsars, and magnetars. Right? So the question that I seek to answer is, what makes up the envelope of a neutron star? Right? And like in the past, it was just like the United States, a two-party system, right? In that it was either hydrogen or iron. And the idea behind picking these two particular elements is that hydrogen is very easy to get, right? You just get it from like outer space. The hydrogen is flowing around everywhere, right? And iron, well, if you believe the story that neutron stars are formed in the,
neutron stars are formed in the remnant, are basically the remnants of collapsed iron cores in supermassive stars, which explode in type 2 supernovae, then you should expect to see iron on the surface. So then we should ask the question, well, why do we care about what makes up the surface of a neutron star? Well, it affects the spectra of the thermal radiation from the surface, and this was first shown by Roger Ramani in 1987, namely that iron is more black body light, whereas hydrogen helium, it gives a harder spectrum than black body at a given effective temperature, right? So this is a slide I usually like to bring to me whenever Lars runs show and tell. So what this is a plot of opacity as a function of photon energy for two different materials, for hydrogen and for iron, right? And for iron, you can notice that iron has a very rich line structure, and so these are temperatures roughly around 10 to the 6 or so. So iron has a very rich line structure. And as a result, when you smooth out the opacities, what you end up getting is that iron stays relatively flat, approximately, okay, across photon energies, whereas hydrogen like falls off like e to the minus 3. Now, why e to the minus 3? Well, that's just because it's due to fully ionized plasmas are basically, the primary opacity in fully ionized plasmas is due to free opacity. And this floor here is set basically by Thomson opacity. All right, so you can imagine what might happen in a neutron star atmosphere, namely that the harder photons, all right, see a lower opacity atmosphere, so they can come from deeper in the atmosphere where it's hotter. All right, so hence you get a harder radiation for the given effective temperature when you have hydrogen versus iron. Okay. The second thing is that it also affects the effective temperature, central temperature relation, right? It was shown in Patek and Charbardi and Yakovlev in 97. And this has implications for neutron star cooling, right? And finally, if you understand what makes up the surface, right, you might be able to get a handle on what the gravitational redshift is from a neutron star, i.e. m over r, and hence get a very good constraint on the nuclear equivalent state. Okay? So with that, I'm going to present an outline of my talk. Okay. All right. So first thing, I'm going to talk about observations before 1E127-56. And what's typified by these, what's typical of these observations is that no spectral lines were ever seen in these X-ray spectra. Then we'll talk about a little bit of the work that Lars and I have been doing over the past year or so, right? Namely, this process which we call diffusive nuclear burning, right? First in diffusive equilibrium, where everything is set by the nuclear physics, and when everything is out of diffusive equilibrium, where diffusion is actually the limiting step, right? I'm also going to talk a little about magnetic fields and how magnetic fields on neutrons on these young objects, i.e., magnetic fields of roughly 10 to 12 Gauss, can affect the structure of the atmosphere and what their implications are for diffusive nuclear burning. And finally, I'm going to talk about the object that's been generating so much excitement in the last year or so, 1E127-56. Talk a little about the X-ray observations of this object and do a little bit of theory on it. So now, hence, with this, I'm going to give you my legalese. I'm just going to talk about radio pulsars and central sources for supernova remnants. I won't discuss older objects like LMXBs, like millisecond pulsars, magnetars, though much of this theory would still apply to those objects. All right? So before I go on, I'm gonna play devil's advocate, right? Shouldn't it be just be hydrogen? I mean, like, this would just be the most obvious thing. And there are lots of strong arguments why it should be hydrogen. First of all, neutron stars are really small, right? They're about the size of Manhattan Island, roughly, right? And hence, you only need a tiny amount of hydrogen to completely coat the surface of a neutron star. In fact, the amount of water in Kachuma Lake could probably easily cover the surface of a neutron star and wrap it completely in hydrogen. Secondly, it's easy to find hydrogen, right? You can get it from the ISM, all right? So you can accrete it from ISM, or if you're forming a supernova explosion, so some of the material in the supernova might fall back, and even that material is hydrogen poor. When it falls back with roughly 200 MeV per nucleon or greater, and the spallation of those nuclei would generate lots of protons. In addition, the fusion times are really small on the surface of a neutron star, it's approximately 1 second or so, right? So hence, the neutron stars, if they're not accreting, should be among some of the purest objects in the universe, because all the heavier stuff sails out on really, really fast timescales, right? But so for accreting objects, a caveat to this, like if you accrete faster than you can fuse, i.e. you accrete more than the mass of the photosphere in the fusion time, right, which roughly translates to about 10 to the minus 12 solar masses a year. The surface, you could have impurities on the surface, all right? An example would be, example which I give for no particular reason, is EXO-0748, right, which was recently observed during type 1 X-ray bursts to exhibit iron lines, all right? But the surface of these objects should still be mostly hydrogen, okay? Well, astrophysics is experimental science, all right? So we have to ask what the observers think of all of this. So what do the observations say, right? So there are two ways of determining surface abundances, right? The first way is, first and easy and most classical way is from atomic lines. So you look for atomic lines in the spectrum. Right, now, it's funny about these about the objects that I'm talking about. These objects have enormous magnetic fields, right? So as a result, the atomic physics for these objects is very, very different from what we expect in like Sakurai or something like that, right? So we're susceptible to both B field and gravitational redshift degeneracies, all right? But hopefully, maybe sets of atomic lines might be able to put some constraints on this, right? The other way around this, if you don't have atomic lines, all right, which was the case before 1E1207, is that you can do detailed models of the spectrum. And from these detailed models, all right, you can do fits to the observation, and for these fits, you can determine what the surface composition would be. Now, the problem with this is that it's very hard to build these detailed models, and as a result, only hydrogen and helium has been done in any detail, all right? And at the end of the day, once you do your hydrogen helium magnetized atmospheres, and you compare the observations and you fit them versus black body, they both give equally good fits in a chi-square sense, right? So that's not great. So how do we fix this problem? So this is basically a discussion of like how surface abundances were determined prior to 1E1207. Okay. So recall that I said in my introductory slide that hydrogen and helium generally give harder spectrum. Oh crap. Generally give harder spectrum than black bodies, all right? And as a result, if you fit a hydrogen helium spectrum to an observation, you tend to get a lower effective temperature than if you fit a black body to the same data set. Right? Now you also have other pieces of information. You have like your counts basically, right, for your detector, and you have the distance. And the distance has been measured like fairly accurately using parallax measurements for a bunch of these objects. So these three ingredients added together, the effective temperature, the luminosity, and distance, should give you the size of the emitting area. Now, if you assume that the emitting area is around or some large fraction or some non-trivial fraction of the size of a neutron star, and you also presume that neutron stars are favored around 10 kilometers or so, all right, then this will give you a favorite model for which particular model would fit the observations a little better. All right, so I'll give a couple of examples first. All right, so this guy is Vela, all right, and like many neutron star spectrum, it breaks down into two components. The first is the power law component, which is always seen in I think in practically all neutron star candidates I know of, right? And the thermal component, right? So you can take the thermal component and try to fit a black body to it, right? Now this distance here of 300 parsecs has been estimated, I believe, from parallax measurements, right? So this you can trust, right? So if you take a black body and you try to fit it to this spectrum, you get a temperature of about 1.5 million Kelvin, all right? Yeah, which will be, yeah, millikelvin would be actually pretty hard to see. All right, that would be like you observe a Kobe, not Chandra, unfortunately, all right? So this gives you a radius of the black body, all right, with approximately 3 kilometers, all right? And presuming that this the emitting surface is like around the size of the neutron star, a 3-kilometer neutron star is highly disfavored by causality. Right. Now, if you take a hydrogen atmosphere to it and you try to fit a hydrogen atmosphere to the same object, you get a significantly lower effective temperature and a significantly larger radius. Right. So this radius is not ruled out by the available nuclear equation of state. So this, you might say, this is more likely a hydrogen atmosphere. Now, this is not great. This is not exactly the best example of this. Best example of hydrogen atmosphere fit to a young object. There are other objects which fit much better, but I think I just like the spectrum for this one better. I don't remember why I picked this one. All right. Okay. Well, here's another example. This is PSRB 0656. All right. And in this case, there's actually two components to the thermal part. There's a hard component and a soft component. Right. Now, if you fit the soft component to a black body, then you get something really quite lovely. You get 12 kilometers for the radius of a neutron star. All right, and this seems to indicate that a black body atmosphere looks a little better for this particular source. All right, and for if you try to fit a hydrogen atmosphere, you get a radius that's uncomfortably large. So this one looks like it might be more not heavy elements, but more black body light composition on the surface. All right.
Hydrogen atmosphere.
Yep.
That's not going to look like black body. So.
No. If you fit them, the right thing to say is that if you fit them to the observations, in the chi-square sense, both fits are equally good. All right. So then you need another constraint to allow you to pick out which one is like the favorite model.
The radius of the emitting
area. Right.
I thought we
No, those are not the two physical possibilities, right? You can, like pretend you're God, right? Okay, you can make a neutron star with anything on the surface, right? Okay, the two were picked because they're the classic possibilities.
But can you say anything about the iron atmosphere?
So this is a highly magnetized source, right? Okay, so a highly magnetized detailed models of iron atmosphere in highly magnetized has never been done. Okay. So what you presume is that iron, because it has a richer line structure, would approximate a black body. That's what you're really saying. That's what the real statement is.
All right. This isn't just presumed, but you cannot say definitely because there is no model.
Yes. All right. So you say, but you can say one thing. You can say this is not hydrogen, for instance. All right. That's what you can say.
Just say also that 500 parsecs is probably not
light. So they've done some new measurements on this one. So this guy, I think now it's down to 200 or 250
that's
or so. Yeah. So this object has had new parallax measurements. So it's everything's out of whack now. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The both chi-square sense in both of these things are about the same or so.
In one model, you have two temperatures coming out, and the other one, you only have one.
Oh, okay. So this is, the both fits are the soft component, all right?
Okay.
The hard component is difficult to understand in either case.
Okay.
What were the error bars on the old distance measurement?
Oh, I actually don't know. But they were a lot less than 100 kiloparsecs, yes. No, the new measurement, which Steve Swartz at UC Santa Cruz has done, gives around like 200, 300 parsecs or something, or kiloparsecs. Yeah, parsecs.
What are the error bars?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Is that
measurement
on that?
Yeah, so, Sue, I'm not supposed to say anything. All right, sorry. God, I take it back. Yeah, well, this is actually this is actually something at the Crete meeting where I got my teeth knocked out. where he said, "Oh, this is wrong distance." I'm like, "Great." All right, so now.
So both those are pulsars. Do those spectra show any variation with pulse phase?
With pulse phase. Okay, I don't remember for these objects if they do. I know for 1E12-7 that they will. What, yeah?
This is 56
pulses. Oh, this is, all right, there. Okay, so if you table this up, right, for all these particular objects, all right, what you find is something that a very interesting trend occurs, right? For objects younger than about 10 to the 4, 10 to 5 years, they seem to favor like a light element atmosphere, like hydrogen or something like that. And for objects that are older than 10 to 4, 10 to 5 years, they seem to favor like a more black body-like atmosphere. All right? So this suggests there's some sort of evolution happening, okay, on the time scale of 10 to the 4, 10 to 5 years, where hydrogen, possibly, is converting itself to more black body-like elements. All right? Now, of course, you can turn this around and say that, well, maybe this is not truly the case. Maybe it's like some weird microphysics and stuff like that. But for now, let's just presume that this is true, and I'll return to the point of the weird microphysics later. Okay, if you ask, well, what generates this evolution? There's only a couple of like really easy candidates known in astrophysics, and the easiest one is probably nuclear processes. All right. But nuclear processes on the surface of neutron stars is actually pretty hard to do, right? And the problem, and we can actually illustrate this problem by comparing the sun's core. So the temperature of photosphere around 10 to the 6, sun's core is about 20 times that, right? Density is about a tenth of a gram of water. Like the density in the sun's core is about 100 times water, all right? And yet we already know that the lifetime for nuclear processes in the sun's core is around 10 to 9 years, about Hubble time or so, all right? So hence, it looked pretty hopeless for nuclear processes on the surface. So now I'm going to start talking about the stuff Lars and I have been doing, i.e. diffuse nuclear burning. Right. So the observation, right? Well, not the observation, but like if you do a model of the atmosphere, you realize that the temperature goes up by one or two, by almost two orders of magnitude if you go down just 10 meters. So neutron stars are very extreme objects, extremely small, extremely massive, right? And they'll have extreme temperature gradients as well. Okay. So the thing is that like if you can get hydrogen down to those depths, you can might be able to burn them fairly efficiently. And this was first studied by Leonard Rosen in the late 60s and early 70s. All right. So here's a model of how I'm going to explain how everything works. So here's a very simple model. I'm going to put hydrogen sitting on top of a carbon layer, all right? And I'm going to define somewhere there's a hydrogen-carbon boundary. Of course, like in any like real system, like this boundary is not a strict boundary. There's always going to be mixing between the two. So as a result, there's going to be a diffusive tail of hydrogen that penetrates deep into the carbon layer. Now, this diffusive tail can penetrate really, really deep and penetrate to such a point where temperatures are around 6 to 8 by 10 to the 7 or so, where nuclear processes start happening quite readily. I'm going to find this area as the burning layer. So this is where hydrogen is basically consuming nuclear processes. All right, so this is a simple, very simple picture of it. So you can imagine what happens. Like hydrogen sits up here. So I set up a tail. I start pulling hydrogen out. This pushes the tail out of the diffuse equilibrium. Hydrogens have to migrate down through the tail in order to get to the burning layer where they're consumed. So as a result, they only have a fixed amount of hydrogen, presuming I have no interstellar accretion, right? And eventually, what will happen is all the hydrogen will be consumed all the way out to the photosphere. All right, so there are two limits to this process. Okay, so temperature, okay, so you could say it's temperature or pressure or temperature and density. But like the pressure density is enormous down here. Right.
Comparable to the solar core.
Oh, much more than that. It just laughs at the solar core, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it looks at the solar core and chuckles, basically. All right, okay. So there are two limits to this process here, right? The first is the fusion time it takes for hydrogen to fuse down to the burning layer, is much less than the nuclear time scale, all right? So that means that the driver in this process is totally the nuclear processes. And the other time scale is that when the diffusion time is approximately equal to or much greater than the nuclear time scale, in that case, the fusion ends up being the driver, all right, for that solar process. So the first thing, so I'm going to talk about this limit first, right, where everything happens in the diffuse equilibrium because it's much easier to illustrate. Okay, so we can ask, how do we actually figure out what the structure of this diffuse tail looks like? All right, so in order to figure out what the diffuse tail looks like in diffuse equilibrium, all right, we write down hydrostatic balance for both the ions and electrons. Now this is slightly, so breaking it into this form is different from what people normally do in envelope physics or in the stars. Normally what people would write down is dp dr equals minus rho g, all right? There's the macroscopic, so this that macroscopic equation basically describes what the hydrostatic structure of a star needs to be. All right. So this is slightly different. So I'm going to break everything up into for both ions and electrons. All right. And as a result, I end up getting this extra macroscopic thing. I guess the electric field basically ends up being important in this context. All right. I set charge neutrality, and I also have to write something for what the temperature profile looks like. And in this case, it turns out that constant flux turns out to be a reasonable approximation. So this is assuming that the amount of burning I have at deep in the envelope is small compared to the flux that's coming through the envelope, which in general is actually a pretty good assumption, right? So I need to solve for the electric field, okay? And actually, Dmitry Udensky showed me how to solve the electric field, like, a long time ago, right? And to show you that it actually everything ends up looking pretty okay. Yeah. I was debating whether I show this graph or not, but I guess I will. All right, so this is the electric field. All right, so this right here is roughly where the hydrogen-carbon boundary sits. All right. So you can see what happens is that the electric field on this end is completely determined by what the background ions are. In this case, it's going to be hydrogen. In this extreme limit, it's going to be carbon, and it gives you really nice sort of like transition between the two. And transition in the order is something like the ion scale height over here, which is sort of nice. Okay. So you can actually, oh my God. All right. I don't know. No wonder people use PowerPoint now these days. All right. So if you actually map this out, you can see what happens to the number fraction. So this here is my diffuser tail. My number fraction of hydrogen is rapidly dropping as a function of depth, right? And you can see here the temperature is rising, right? So this just comes from constant flux. So any idiot can solve this equation, right? But this number fraction takes a special sort of idiot to solve.
Tell me what the variable on the
x-axis
there is, not familiar.
Oh, okay. All right, so this is in terms of column. This is the total amount of stuff that sits above your head, basically. All right, so this is basically pressure divided by gravity, the total amount of stuff that sits above your head. Right. Okay. So let's throw some nuclear physics into this mix. How do we do that? The local rate of nuclear burning is roughly the number density of hydrogen that you have divided by the local lifetime that hydrogen will have like to nuclear reactions. All right, so there are two possible reactions here. Okay, oh, I forgot to write down the full reaction for the second one. All right, so first is PP. Right, so like proton captures a proton, makes deuterium, maybe that goes on and does something. But this process turns out to be slow. This first step, because of the dependence on the weak interaction, turns out to be really, really slow. Right, the yellow process that happens, that might happen if you have hydrogen sitting on top of carbon, is that carbon might just capture a proton. So I didn't write down the full reaction, so I'm going to say it right now. The proton captures on the carbon, makes nitrogen-13. Nitrogen-13 waits around for 10 minutes, like emits a beta particle and a neutrino, right, and decays to carbon-13. Carbon-13 has a large A over Z relative to carbon, i.e. like A over 13 over divided by 6 is greater than 2, right? So the carbon-13 ends up sinking, right? So we can integrate this. So this process turns out to be the more important process for diffuse nuclear burning, right? And we can integrate this burning rate just to see, just to define what a column lifetime would be, right? So integrate the local rate over the entire envelope gives me the rate at which the column is being consumed, and from the rate at which the column is being consumed gives me what the column e-folding time would be, roughly. Right. So what I've plotted here is to show you where the burning actually occurs. Right. So this here, you can imagine, is the burning rate per pressure scale height or so. Right. And down here, I've plotted two things. First is the fractional number density of hydrogen versus the temperature. And you can see what happens here, right? The temperature is rising, and because nuclear processes are extremely temperature sensitive, they tend to rise rapidly with temperature, right? So what causes this peak? Well, eventually the temperature starts to fall over because it becomes isothermal in the conductive region of the envelope. Right? But at the same time, the number density is exponentially dropping. So as a result, you get this really nice gamma of peak, which you can actually analytically calculate if you are so interested in doing so. But I mean, the basics is that this little peak here basically defines what my burning region will look like.
Right.
Yes. So it's constant flux. So you could so I should mention a couple of things, right? So it's constant flux, right? And so you can ask yourself, well, doesn't the fact that you are burning material, right, by nuclear processes break constant flux? Well, yes, it breaks constant flux on a really, really low rate. For instance, like my effective temperature here is about 8 × 10⁵ Kelvin, all right, and the amount of material I'm consuming less than, like, I guess, I'm consuming 1 gram per square centimeter every 4 years or so. So it's constant flux is violated, but on a very, very small scale. So if I plot this, if I plot what the column lifetime is against what the, so right here, this is my integrated hydrogen column. So this is the amount of hydrogen I have throughout my entire column. And I ask myself, well, what does this hydrogen column do? What does the lifetime do as a function of the thickness of the envelope? All right. So you can imagine what happens. I start at some point here, my total hydrogen column, and then I slowly eat away, all right, until I come to the photosphere, right? So because of the parallel nature dependence of this, the true lifetime of the column, right? Not just the e-folding, but the total lifetime of the column is basically determined by what the column lifetime would be at the photosphere, right? So this is fairly simple. I mean, that's all there is really to it, right? So the thing is that I showed before that, like, the time scale for evolution was roughly 10⁴ × 10⁵ years, right? So that's around here, or so, okay. So the thing is that unfortunately I need quite a bit of fine tuning in order to make that work, all right. But for large amounts of parameter space, I can easily burn off all the hydrogen in, like, much shorter time scales than that.
So the time scale is very sensitive to central.
It's very sensitive to central temperature. Yeah. Right. Yes, that's what it means. So because the burning layer temperature is linearly dependent on center temperature, but the nuclear process is exponentially sensitive to this temperature. So you can get enormous ranges in, like, what the column lifetime would be.
But what core temperature do you expect at that age?
Oh, okay. So that's a good question.
Four, 10 to 5 years.
What core? Oh, I see. So at that age, you expect something, you actually expect something actually higher than this, roughly 8 by 10 to the 7 to almost 10 to the 8 Kelvin or so. All right. The reason why now, so the effective temperature for these young pulsars is actually pretty hot. All right. So the hydrogen does not last very long on these objects. All right. Now, of course, I should say that what I've been doing up to this point is for the B equals zero case. So like maybe the magnetic case would be different, but I'll show you later. It's not really that much different. Okay. So. The thing is that like this is great, but eventually the fusion equilibrium will break down. All right. So what happens when it does break down, or if a popular network had to, right, when drag forces attack? All right. So the time scale for diffusion, well, what's the time scale for diffusion? Well, it's basically the ion scale height squared divided by what the diffusion coefficient is. Now you can ask me why you picked the ion scale height. Well, okay, there are two reasons why I picked it. All right, the first reason is because I know what the answer is already, all right, without this sort of order of magnitude estimate. And the second reason is the ions, like above the ion scale, if for length scales greater than ion scale height, what determines what the time scale for diffusion actually is the drift velocity. Below that is actually what the diffusion time would be. All right, so we can say diffusive equilibrium is going to be violated when this diffusion time is roughly equal to nuclear time. Right. So plotting this in sort of like I guess what more microphysics oriented units like i.e. density versus temperature. All right. So I plot for three different models. All right. One by 8 by 10 to the 5. One is 10 to the 6, and one is 1.2 by 10 to the 6 or so. All right. So and in red I've outlined where the burning regions would be if I just close my eyes and pretend everything is always in diffuse equilibrium, right? So you can see what happens here, right? For this case, for the 8 by 10 to the 5 case, I mean, I'm always in diffuse equilibrium. I'm safe, right? So like the theory up to this point works for this guy, but for around 10 to the 6 or so, this becomes to be like diffuse equilibrium begins to be violent, and for even higher temperatures, all right, the diffuse equilibrium is totally violent. So like diffuse equilibrium would not work for this model, which is like 1.2 by 10 to the 6 or so. All right. And this is completely due to the fact that nuclear processes are extraordinarily sensitive to temperature. All right. But we actually want to calculate something real for this. All right. So let's look back at and see how diffusion actually ends up affecting our diffusive tail. All right, so if I write down, like initially for diffuse equilibrium, I can just write down hydrostatic balance for each of these ions. And for these ions, I've picked as carbon and hydrogen. All right. But when you're not in diffuse equilibrium, all right, and we're going to presume that hydrogen is going to be the trace element here in the background, all right, then what happens is that you end up getting a term which basically looks like a drag force. Now this force is always there, right? And usually we can ignore it because it's very, very small, right? But when diffuse equilibrium is violated, i.e., so you can imagine that I have a current of hydrogen running down, and eventually the current of hydrogen runs so fast that like the drag force has become important, all right? Then what happens is the drag force ends up cutting off the number density of hydrogen extremely rapidly, right? So there's actually another way of stating this, which actually turns out to be much simpler and much clearer, right? And that is to take what steady-state continuity is to take steady-state continuity, all right? So we have actually seen this equation in another form already, right? This equation right here, right, is basically hydrostatic balance for each of these ions, right? Okay, so this is the current. So when this equals zero, we basically have a hydrostatic balance for each of the ions. All right. So we take the steady state continuity equation. All right, and taking the form of current in terms of what the concentration gradient is and what the drift velocity would be gives us this simple equation which we have to work with. Now this is presuming that the diffusion coefficient and the drift velocity are constants. All right, and for argument's sake, let's just presume that they are. So for our ansatz to solve this equation, we can basically take a correction factor, which I call F, times the J equals zero solution, which we know how to solve already, all right? So this is the equation that we solved initially from diffuse equilibrium. Right? So we take this onset, and miraculously, everything reduces down to something extremely simple, right? Where you have like two scale heights. The first scale height, you know, this is basically the ion scale height, right? And the second scale height is something new that we haven't looked at, that we haven't seen before, and this is the nuclear scale height, right? Now, when you're burning in the diffusion limited case, all right, the ion scale height is much, much bigger than the nuclear scale height. So basically, you could just reduce your equation down to this. All right? So this is a very simple, I'm not sure what equation this is, actually. Does anyone know? Right. This is a classic equation. Wave? Not wave. But whatever. All right. Okay. So what's the advantage of doing this this way? Well, all technology that we've done, right, basically in solving this equation, can be I guess used again to solve the case when stuff is no longer in diffuse equilibrium with the addition of this equation. So everything turns out to be a lot easier. Right, so let's show an example how that sort of works. Okay, so this is again the nuclear burning rate, all right, as a function of how much stuff sits above you, all right? So you can see, so this presumes, I close my eyes and presume that everything's in diffuse equilibrium, all right? And I get this nice gamma-like peak as I did before, all right? And this is the one taking diffusion into account. And you see what happens. Like the number density of hydrogen is, the number density of hydrogen is the same as the case when we presume diffuse equilibrium, up to the point where diffuse equilibrium is violated. And when it is violated, it gets cut off extremely rapidly. And this cutoff happens basically on the nuclear scale height. Right? So as a result, you end up getting this gamma peak ends up getting cut off at a certain temperature. Right? So that's basically all that happens when you take diffusion into account. You end up cutting off the amount of like stuff you have at a certain depth. Right? So
this is a collaboration between the nuclear processes and not just the diffusive one. So it's basically what's happening there is that you're burning so rapidly.
So what happens is that you can imagine, all right, so what happens is that the maximum amount, so you can imagine what's the max rate of current that can possibly pass through? Well, it's just going to be like the number density at that depth times what the maximum drift velocity will possibly be. All right. So eventually, if you eat more than the maximum amount of velocity, then the maximum amount of current that you actually flow down at that is basically what sets that.
Okay.
Good. All right. So we plot this against central core temperature. All right. We actually get two very nice regimes. All right. The first is when stuff is in diffuse equilibrium. So you can see this steep dependence on temperature. And this steep dependence on temperature is simply due to the fact that in this regime, we're complete nuclear process driven. So as a result, we expect a steep temperature gradient, a steep temperature dependence. If you move to a higher temperature, then diffusion begins to call all the shots. And when diffusion calls all the shots, the steep temperature dependence on nuclear processes no longer factors in. So we get a much weaker temperature dependence as a result. Right, and these scalings, actually, you can calculate these scalings actually just from the, so this scaling actually just comes from nuclear processes aspect, and this scaling just comes from diffusion, just the envelope structure. Good. Okay. All right. So just when things could not get any worse, all right, I'm throw magnetic fields into the mix, all right, and the magnetic fields. Which I'm going to talk about, run the gamut from 10 to 9 Gauss up to 10 to 13 Gauss. So you ask, why this particular range? Well, 10 to 9 Gauss, magnetic fields begin to affect what the atomic structure would look like. Basically, this is where the radius gyration is approximately equal to the Bohr radius.
So before you go on, with the slower temperature dependence,
right.
Where these neutron stars are.
Right.
Does that... So the punchline is it does or does not explain burning hydrogen 10 to the 4 times.
No. I mean, like, if it doesn't work in diffuse equilibrium, all right, because we know the diffusive equilibrium happens on like much shorter, on much shorter time scale, 10 to 4, 10 to 5 years. It's definitely not going to work when we're out of equilibrium, right? Because you just, yeah, because you increase the temperature, you're just burning faster.
Right.
No matter what happens, you're just burning faster.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Maybe I can save this later. I don't know. We'll see. Okay. So the reason why I picked these two is the radius gyration is about equal to Bohr rate, so the atomic physics starts getting affected by the magnetic field. And the second one is I'm going to ignore the fact that the ions are going to be affected by the magnetic field, so I pick something less than 10 to 14 Gauss. So there are two main effects for magnetic field. The first is the electron equation of state, all right? And for degenerate electrons, what happens is that when their Fermi energy is less than the cyclotron energy, right, they tend to form lambda levels around the magnet field. And as a result, they tend to look like a one-dimensional Fermi gas. And when you have a one-dimensional Fermi gas, the scaling with pressure and density is different from what you have normally. All right, so that's the first thing. So this turns out to be not super important in affecting what our calculations will end up looking like. The second more significant effect is due to the opacity. And it's basically the same idea. So the opacities, i.e. free opacity or conductive opacity, basically come from the fact that you're solving the collision integral in the Boltzmann equation. And when you have a strong B field, all right, i.e. a 1D Fermi gas, you reduce the phase space at which electrons can scatter into. Right? And by reducing the phase space electrons can scatter into, you can modify the opacity significantly. Right? Now, the thing is that the opacity, this depends just on the B field strength, the electron equation of state. But this depends both on the B field and the orientation of the magnet field. So, and it turns out to be the more important effect. So here I can show you a graph of how this will work. So I've plotted what the effective temperature would be, right, as a function of neutron star latitude. So this is the magnetic pole where the magnet field is a radial, and this is the equator where the magnet field is a parallel to the surface. And you get roughly a factor of 3. So this is fixed core temperature. You get roughly a factor of 3 between the two, and that completely results from the fact that from orientation effects in the magnetic field. I should have written down. All right, so this magnetic field is roughly 10 to 12 Gauss. So you can ask, what does this do to diffusive nuclear burning? Okay. Well, surprisingly, it's not a huge effect if we plot this in terms of the effective temperature, because the burning region is really dependent on what the radiative opacities are going to be. So it ends up not being a huge effect. It ends up not being a tremendous effect. So you can see this in this bottom graph right here. So this is the case. So this is the same effective temperature for both cases. Same column of hydrogen, and you can see that the effect is roughly just about a factor of 5 or so. All right. Now compared to the orders and orders of magnitude I can get from varying in temperature up and down, a factor of 5 is not terribly much. All right. This actually shows a little bit clearer. All right. All right. So here I plotted what the burning would be as a function of effective temperature versus what the column lactate would be as a function of effective temperature versus what the column lactate would be as a function of core temperature. All right. So this is here's our factor of 2, 3 to 5 or so. All right. But here we get a far much larger we get stuff that's much larger in magnitude. And the reason for this is because the T effective T correlation is more effective because in the conductive zone, magnetic fields affect the electron conductivity. And hence, as a result, we have like we basically build on what the T effective T burning layer relation would be in the B equals zero case. So now let's go on to 1E127-56. So I realized last night I had to give some background on this object first, right? So this 1E127-56 12.7 minus 56 is a radial quiet central source associated with a supernova around G296. It was discovered by Einstein in 84, the satellite, not the scientist. All right. The age of the supernova remnant is about 7 kiloyears. Okay, and this was measured by looking in the radio at the supernova shell and how and the rate at which it was expanding. And POP dot measurements, and so you can ask, oh, is this radio quiet? How do you get POP dot? This is from X-ray observations in two different periods, in 2000 and 2002. And POP dot gives a spin down time of roughly 200 kiloyears. All right, so it's this old problem with
spin period.
Oh, I forgot.
It's
400 milliseconds. Yeah. All right. So let's show the data for this object. All right. So these are observations. So this is observations from George Pavlov's group, and this observation from Marangetti and DeLuca and the XMM group. So this is Chandra data. This is XMM data. All right. So the most obvious thing about this is that there are these two what appear to be absorption features at 0.7 1.4 keV, all right? And both of them and both of these features are seen both in the XMM and the Chandra data. There's also something maybe that looks like it's happening at 2 keV, and it's also seen in the XMM data as well. So this is still up, but the 2 kV is still up to date, but the fact that it's seen in two data sets tends to lend credence that this is actually a real feature. All right. So eventually I'm going to talk about what those lines look like, but before I do, the one interesting thing about the XMM data is that they also have spectral resolve. They also show that when you have phase resolved spectra, that these features are phase dependent. All right, so if you look at the peak maximum, all right, what you find is the 1.4 keV feature seems to be absent, all right, whereas so the 1.4 keV feature tends to vary with the phase, right? Now, if you try to look for this phase variation in the Chandra data, this is actually not seen, and right now, it's not clear exactly why this is the case. So I wanted to present this, but I'm not going to say terribly much about it because I'm not sure if anyone really understands why this is happening.
Well, then you took a much larger data set.
Yeah, well, this is a 200 kilosecond data set, right? Yeah, okay, so we have to see. We have to wait and see. So they took a 250 kilosecond data set recently. This is back in, like, April or something like that. A long time ago, but like they haven't released any new information. So let me give you some characteristics of this object. So we have lines at 0.7 and 1.4. We have something maybe at 2. Okay, and so let's walk through the interpretation of these lines. So okay, first of all, from the POP dot measurements acquired by Chandra observations, right, the B field looks like it's around 2 to 3 to 5 like times 10 to the 12 Gauss or so, right. So if you take the impression that these are electron cyclotron lines, this would apply a B field roughly 6 by 10 to the 10 to 10 to 11 Gauss magnetic fields, which is inconsistent with the POP dot measurements. If you take ion cyclotron lines, right, then you're going to get B fields around to in excess of 10 to 14 Gauss. Right, so what you're left with is atomic line, right? And there are two candidates for what these atomic lines might be. The first candidate, suggested by George Pavlov, is that these are helium lines at 10 to the 14 Gauss. All right, now, you can ask, well, helium at 10 to the 14 Gauss, I mean, why can't it be ion cyclotron at 10 to the 14 Gauss? Well, okay, so you can say, and this seems to be inconsistent with the POP dot measurements as well. Right. Well, you can save this by saying it's an off-center dipole, right? So that this POP dot measurement is for presuming dipole spin down. So if you have off-center dipole, you might be able to save this, right? But then this also opens up the possibility that it could be ion cyclotron lines as well. A more realistic interpretation of these lines is given by Chuck Haley and Kelly Morey at Columbia, where they interpret these as oxygen or neon lines at a B field roughly 10 to 12 Gauss, which would be more consistent with the POP dot measurements. And the way they did it is that they have this massive cone that is able to churn through all the atomic transitions for highly magnetized atoms, right? And calculate all the energies of transition that are possible. And it seems that our oxygen or neon lines seem to be most favored. But no matter what the interpretation of these atomic lines are, these atomic lines do not belong to hydrogen, because no pair of hydrogen lines for any sort of realistic sort of B field and redshift can actually produce the lines that are observed. Right? So I decided to run this diffuse nuclear burning stuff. So can you get rid of these lines in 7,000 years or so? Right? So I ran through I ran their model through my diffuse nuclear burning codes, all right, to see what happens. So these are the favorite models they have. So this is for oxygen, all right. So this is for the redshift and the B field. So this should be B12. I'm sorry, I didn't write that down, all right. So this should be B12 or so, okay. So this enormous gulf here is due to the fact that they're burning hydrogen in diffuse equilibrium, all right, and this is just the dependence on gravity as a result. So I fixed the effective temperature from, so this is sort of a lower limit. The effective temperature I get from Marenghetti et al. Into Marenghetti et al. Hydrogen atmosphere fit, and this is not consistent with the fact that this would be oxygen atmosphere. But since no one's actually built a full-fledged oxygen atmosphere, I do the best that I can, fortunately. Right. So this is the effective temp. So this, I take the effective temperature from hydrogen atmosphere fit and ask myself, well, what's the lifetime? What's the column lifetime as a function of the hydrogen element? So you can see here, this here will be the photosphere, all right, and this is the age of a supernova. For a large amount of parameter space, I can easily burn up all the hydrogen, right, via diffuse nuclear burning, right, in the life, given the age of the supernova remnant.
Is that on carbon or oxygen?
This is on oxygen.
On oxygen.
Yes.
This is hydrogen on oxygen
model, right? So this is everything that I can be consistent with, I've tried to be consistent with, right? Okay. But then we can ask, if you believe diffusion happens at really rapid timescales on neutron stars and stuff, you can ask, well, if you're gonna put hydrogen on the surface, you're gonna build hydrogen and then helium and then carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, blah blah blah. Right, all the way through. Okay, so you can ask yourself, well, what happened to helium? And diffuse nuclear also doesn't provide an answer like, why would the surface emit oxygen? Why would the underlying surface be oxygen? All right, so that's all I really have for 1E1207. And with that, I'm going to put up my conclusion slide. And with my conclusion, I decided to be a little more controversial. All right, because it's my talk. So to summarize, right? So observations prior to 1E1207 suggested that there was some sort of evolution from hydrogen to something else in 4 or 5 years. But this could always, but the worry was that this was always due to some strange microphysics. Maybe there's molecules forming in magnetic atomic molecules forming on the surface or whatnot. Right? But these atomic lines from 1E1207 suggest that this evolution is real. If you believe the initial devil's advocate slide that you would expect hydrogen, right? There must be a way to get rid of this hydrogen in on this time scale. So this evolution might be real. Right? Diffuse nuclear burning can account for this evolution, all right? But it's hard to do in the 10 to 4 or 10 to 5 year time scale. It requires a lot of fine tuning, right? I.e. you have to either go from carbon. You can't pick carbon. You may have to pick oxygen or pick something a little more exotic to sit in the underlying surface. But it's easy to do in less time than 10 to 4, 10 to 5 years. So maybe all these observations of hydrogen to something else, maybe they were always observing helium to something else in those 10 to 4 to 5 years. It was always difficult to discern whether or not it was hydrogen on the surface or helium on the surface, just from observations. But from the devil's advocate viewpoint, it was always easier to suggest it was always hydrogen. Right? But the diffuse nuclear can't explain what happens to the helium. Right? So the helium should still sit there, or what the underlying surface would ultimately end up being looking like. So just a future work, obvious, would be what does helium end up doing to it? Right? In order to do this, we have to take account of Coulomb physics as well. So Coulomb physics for strongly for 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 Coulomb physics in order to take account for what the equilibrium structure of helium would be in the envelope. And we also also looking at diffusion equilibrium for helium, which at first glance seems a little bit crazy. But the thing is that strongly screened nuclear reactions can greatly enhance the burning rate of these plasmas. So diffuse nuclear burning may work for helium as well. And that's it for my talk. Okay, which one?
Well, the one of
1207. All right.
Wondering if those entities, they kind of look like they were in ratios of 1:2.
Yeah. So they are wonderful, like 1:2. Maybe this is 2, but it could be 2.1. So 1:2:3. Yeah, so like if you look at this and you ask, well, what could this be? This looks like this might be like the first Landau level, it's the second Landau level and stuff for electron cyclotron lines, right? So it looks strongly suggested, but it's inconsistent with what the POP dot measurements would be for this object.
I don't have any judgment in this field, but that didn't seem incredibly decisive to me. I mean, there should be something else slowing the pulsar down.
Okay. Yes, there are.
Half a second. For half a second, it's hard to understand what else could be causing spin down at that period.
Yeah.
Well, isn't the slow rotation? Is the magnetic field inferred from P dot too large or too small?
It's too large.
Too large.
For ion cyclotron lines.
So what is the
for electron cyclotron lines?
Pardon. What is the P over P dot?
The P over.
2 by 10 to 12.
2 by 10. Yeah.
It's 2 by 10 to 12.
Yeah, 3 by 10 as well. What do you need for the cyclotron lines? Like 10 to 11, roughly. Yeah. Right. So you can actually get this from the electron cyclotron lines is roughly 10 keV at 10 to 12 Gauss. So the features are seen at 0.7 and 1.4. All right. So you know this is going to be around 10 to 11 Gauss or so. And 2.1, maybe, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, there are two things happening in two different data sets. So yeah, it looks like something real, not something they make up. Could be like there's something wrong with the fitting, I don't know.
Can you put up the plot with the face as well?
Oh, okay.
Okay, so this is
sort of strange. So this is peak, falling, valley, rising. So this is peak, falling, valley, rising. All right. So in the max, all right, the 1.4 feature seems to be absent. So this has only been seen in the XMM data. This has not been seen in the Chandra data. Yeah. All right.
I'm just wondering, is it just that these lines are in some other line continuum and the rise and fall of the light curve is caused by another component, is it just that component maybe can be washing them out? Say there's like a hot spot on the surface causing the pulsations or something.
Right. Yeah, all right, so. The thing is, if that were true, I would actually almost expect the 0.7 kV feature to be absent, right? Not the 1.4. And you can see that from what causes hotspots on neutron stars? Well, if we go back to my initial plot of so the hot spot, so like this, the temperature of neutrons, the temperature of the core is uniform, right? So if the hot spot, if it's going to happen anywhere, it's going to happen near the pole, right? So let's assume it's a dipolar structure. So if it's a dipolar structure, then if this is 10 to 12 Gauss here, this is about 5 by 10 to 11 Gauss here, about half that. All right. So we presume that when this peak happens, we're looking at the hot spot, i.e. the pole, All right. Then we're going to expect to see like the we're going to expect to see the stronger component there, right? I.e., like maybe the 1.4 keV component, because the magnetic field is stronger there, right? But that's not what happens. The 1.4 actually is absent in that case. So yeah, I do not have a very good understanding of why this happens at all at this point. It's also funny, like you expect, like, so the magnetic field is varying, right? Because if you assume a dipolar structure on the surface, the magnetic field should be varying, right? But like the thing is that the 0.7 is always there. So like it looks like it strongly suggests that this is, so there's if it's atomic features, because it's weakly dependent on what the magnetic field is doing.
Right on cyclotron,
right.
Granted, I have no experience in looking at these things.
Right.
But to me, it seems like the energy level of the first dip moves with this.
Energy level of the first
so,
dip.
Like 0.7, 0.7 at the rise.
Right. Okay, yeah, so this is also another interesting feature about this particular observation. Yeah. So you get, all right, so I'm gonna put up the, so this is Chandra, all right? So this looks like a dip, and this is XMM. And it looks like there's some substructure there as well, right? So what you might be seeing in this phase varying, in this phase result spectrum, is not the actual dip moving, but the actual substructure in the absorbed feature that's actually moving around in phase with the rotation. Maybe. I mean, it's tough to see. Because like this wasn't seen in Chandra data at all. I mean, they did a data reduction, apply the same methodology, didn't see any phase variation.
Wasn't seen in the Chandra data, like, they didn't have the statistics to see this, right? So, is that right? Or are you saying that at the strength that this is seen in XMM, should they have seen it in the Chandra data?
All right, so that I don't know. But they did the same. Kylie Moore and Chuck Haley did the same analysis on the Chandra data and reported no phase varying features, but they didn't have a spectrum to go along with it. Right, so it's hard to tell.
But about the error bars when the Chandra spectrum compared to the XMM spectrum, about the statistics in the XMM,
thank you. Yeah, probably. I mean, like XMM has a lot more collecting area. Yeah, it's probably a little better. Whoops.
Can you say anything about what column of electrons is needed to produce that much absorption? If it is
what column of electrons? No, I can't say anything about that. Yeah. You mean in an interstellar medium or?
No, I'm
you're thinking on.
I'm wondering if the electrons are at the photosphere.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway.
No, take me a while of data.
The short answer is no.
No. Short answer is no. Long answer is it'll take me a while of data to do that. Right. You mean this one right here? Well, I mean, like it's an eye test at this point. This is it's really an eye test at this point. All right. I mean, like these two features are unambiguous. This feature I'm already somewhat doubtful. But like there's might be something going on over here as well. But like, yeah.
At this signal to noise level, I wouldn't trust anything.
Right.
3 or 4
right.
So. I think we reached the lowest signal to noise.
Lowest signal to noise. All right.